Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Extra Serving, a podcast by The Last Bite Network, a production of Nation's Restaurant News and Restaurant Hospitality. I'm your host, Holly Petrie, here with today's episode. This week on The Last Bite Network, Takeaway with Sam Okus aired an episode with Jill Taylor, CEO of the 40-unit Burgerville, where they discuss how taking care of your people, product, and planet can lead to profit. In the Kitchen with Brett Thorne featured Francisco Magoya, co-author of Modernist Pizza, who shared the myths, legends, and styles of the world's most popular flatbread. It was very informative, I can promise you that. Definitely worth a listen. I am joined by two of my wonderful colleagues.
My name is Sam Okus, editor-in-chief of Nation's Restaurant News.
My name is Leanne Zinsmeister, managing editor of Nation's Restaurant News.
I never say my title on here. Oh, well.
Do you have a title?
No, I just show up here every day and I'm like,
what do you do, Holly? What's your job?
You're just the do it person. You just do the stuff.
I just, you know, be with my two bosses here. I just do the stuff.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Cool.
Jack of all trades, Holly Petrie.
That's right.
Well, so this week started our fun earnings roundup. We had McDonald's report, Yum Brands, Noodles, Starbucks, some of the big ones. So what did you guys think about our first week of our earnings palooza? There was a lot of positive numbers.
Yeah, I think, there's definitely strong signs that business is much more back to normal. You know, there's definitely still industry still dealing with some things here and there that it's being held back in a number of ways by pandemic related things. But yeah, I mean, it's safe to say that the sales are getting back more to where they were pre-pandemic. I know we saw this last quarter too, especially because last quarter encapsulated June when we briefly all pretended life was normal for a second. But now too, I think now that Delta is ebbing, restaurants can show that their performance is much more in line now with 2019. Of course, all the typical caveats, what we're seeing in the sales reports, you know, Noodles in particular, we see a 16% sales jump. That's great. You know, when you're comparing it to 2020, caveat, you know, you just have to know that over 2020 isn't always saying much because 2020 was such a tough year. But for those brands that are showing the growth over 2019, that's really the encouraging news here, which is that we're not just back to pre-pandemic levels, but we're even exceeding those. And so, you know, restaurants can start to plan a little bit more accordingly for the future and not just the immediate past, which has been holding them down.
Yeah, and brands are also starting to grow units again, which is really encouraging. Yum Brands added 760 restaurants between their brands in the most recent quarter, which is great to see. I think that's a 4% growth rate. So yeah, things are definitely looking brighter, even amid all the struggles with labor and supply chain and everything. There's some good momentum here.
Yeah, I'd say that before the McDonald's numbers came out, everybody was sending emails to us like, beware McDonald's. They're going to see all of these negative numbers, the check prices. And so, but we didn't see that. So analysts were wrong in predicting the numbers, it seems, though that can be a common occurrence. So,
well, oh boy, shots fired at analysts. I know, right? Whoa, geez, coming in hot here.
Holly, we need them. Yeah. McDonald's did also say that their check growth is up, average check are growing, and they're seeing good numbers from their price increases, which is probably encouraging for everyone because that's something that a lot of brands are putting into place right now, is menu price increases. So it's good to see a brand like McDonald's succeeding with those strategies.
Yeah, and so Starbucks just reported last night, we're recording Friday morning, Starbucks just reported last night, they also saw some increases, which is interesting because, Leanne, as you reported yesterday, they increased wages three times in like 14 months or something like that. So they're seeing an increase in wages, but they're also seeing an increase in income.
They will have, yeah. Starbucks actually told me yesterday that their workforce investments between, I want to say it's like last November and this coming January, so that like 15-month range there, they will have invested over $1 billion into their workforce. That includes 3 pay increases for hourly employees. And then this week they announced a ton of investments in their workforce, included upgraded equipment, an app that they're using to schedule shifts, things like that. So yes, it's also nice to see things like that paying off for a brand, especially when everyone's fighting for labor.
Yeah, I think that any evidence we can see that companies are not, they don't suffer from increasing their pay, any evidence we can get in this regard is really great news. You know, it just to quickly reference my interview with Jill Taylor from Burgerville at Takeaway, go listen to that, because, you know, one of the things we talked a lot about was how they take care of their people, they take care of the planet, and they take care of their products. So they're doing a lot of sustainability. They're doing local sourcing, but then they're also, you know, they provide health insurance for their employees. They have been providing financial support through COVID. They're doing educational things for them. And now admittedly, Burgerville is 40 units. Starbucks is what, 16,000 or whatever. So it's a little bit of a different ballgame. But, you know, point is, you know, all along, I think operators look at their P&L and they can get intimidated by these extra investments in labor and things like that. But there are companies out there proving that it can be profitable, you know, and, you know, talk about the cost of turnover. Turnover is expensive too. And so if you want to make sure your employees are not turning over, you want to invest in them and have some long-term success in that regard, this is how you do it. So yeah, I'm encouraged by Starbucks having strong results and putting their money where their mouth is in terms of actually, you know, really investing in their team. And I hope other companies follow suit.
I've definitely heard from people I've known who've worked at Starbucks over the years that it is a great place to work. They really do. Employees seem to love it. We don't hear that story as much as we do from a place like Chick-fil-A. But I've definitely heard from employees that they do love, there's a lot of benefits to working there in terms of like college tuition and those kind of things. So they have invested in employees. I'd say for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And at such a scale as that too, even Chick-fil-A, I mean, even you compare it to Chick-fil-A, Chick-fil-A is significantly smaller than Starbucks. I mean, in terms of footprint, you know, Chick-fil-A has 3,000 locations, whatever. And so just when you think about the sheer scale of these businesses and the hundreds of thousands of people who work there, you know, you're always going to have some bad examples. You know, you hear these horror stories of so-and-so worked for this company and this is, you know, the thing that happened. It's like, well, you know, when you have 16,000 locations, that's bound to happen. And so to create a culture at that scale that can make people proud to work there, can deliver on their education, can deliver on their well-being and deliver on, you know, making sure that they have a living wage. That's a model that I hope other restaurant companies can follow, because, you know, we've talked about this a lot in the last couple of weeks, but you really have no choice at this point. If you're not going to get there with pay, certainly, but also with, as Jill Taylor in my interview with her talked about, you know, treat your employees like they're people who are there for a vocation. If you treat them like this is something bigger than them, they're part of a bigger thing, a mission, you know, they're going to be invested in your success. And that's a good thing for the business as much as it's a good thing for them.
So basically, go and listen to Takeaway if you want to hear more about labor, is what he's saying.
Yeah. What are you doing on this podcast? Go listen to my podcast.
Listen to Takeaway. Read my story about Starbucks labor investments.
That's right. We've
all got a plug. That's right. Here.
I have nothing to plug except myself. Nothing.
We should keep it that way.
And who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, the do it person, right?
Well, guess what it's time for now? It's time to talk about sports.
Yay! I like sports.
Oh, they both perked right up. Oh my goodness.
Careful, Holly, because you might get a conversation about Cleveland sports over here, because Leanne and I can riff on that.
We've got a couple Cleveland sports fans in the house.
Yep.
Well, so World Series is coming up.
No. That's not actually related to Cleveland sports.
It's not, because Cleveland's not... No comment on Cleveland teams here in baseball, but
oh boy. But also the World Series is ongoing. It's two games. It's in progress.
It has already begun.
Yep.
But so who are you guys rooting for?
Okay, so this, Leanne and I both jumped at the mic on this one. I'll go first, but I'm sure it's some version of this. But, you know, I have, as a Cleveland fan, a deep hatred for the Atlanta Braves because they, of course, beat us in the 1995 World Series, which is about the time I became a fan, and I was deeply, deeply hurt by that. However, I ain't gonna vote. I ain't gonna cheer for a cheater. You cannot cheer for the Houston Astros. Sorry, everybody living in Houston or as an Astros fan, but no, that's a hard stop. So I gotta suck it up and cheer for the Braves.
I'm in a similar spot, actually, because one of my closest friends is an Atlanta Braves fan, and so I'm kind of aligning myself with. But also the not over the Astros incidents of. Was that 2019? So
17? Is it been a time is
I'll tell you it was not 2016, which is the last time Cleveland went to the World Series, but
correct. Yep.
And I'm sorry, what happened to them at the World Series?
Wait 1 second before we get into that, because it was a great World Series, and we are all happy the Cubs won. I think we can all say that it's fine that we lost to the Cubs because it was the Cubs.
If it couldn't and be Cleveland, the Cubs were a fine team to lose to that year.
Exactly. Yes. And the Cavs had won earlier that year, so the monkey was off our back. So anyway.
The curse had been lifted.
Anyway, do you see what you did here, Holly? You really got us going. You got to be careful.
Well, we are talking about sports related to food because this week Jack in the Box released its new line of Jack Leets.
It rhymes with athletes, which are people who play sports.
But saying it with Jack in it is just, it's so confusing. So they released their new line of Jack Leets. That's also Taco John's also has a line of its John Bassetters. So these are all people who have either Jack or John somewhere in their name and are college athletes. So it seems like a lot of these brands are getting on board with college athletes, something that they weren't previously allowed to do. Which is very interesting.
So a lot of momentum here for the last couple of months because of the, is it NIL, name, image? Is that yep. What? Yeah. So
name, image, likeness.
Likeness. That's the one. Okay. So it's look, this is first and foremost, let's just say this is great for the athletes. I mean, I think I really like this movement for their sake. We all can, maybe most of us can all agree that, you know, they should have been able to profit off of their name while they were college students for a long time. And unfortunately it's just recently that they couldn't. And so it's great to see that this is happening. And I think what Jack in the Box has done very well here is found a nice theme for themselves, because in the rush to sign all of these college athletes, I'm also reminded, I don't know who any of these people are. You know, like, it's one thing to go sign up the, you know, next LeBron James of, you know, who's going to be the next number one pick, and they're going to be a surefire bet in image. But, you know, there's not a lot of those out there. So I guess I'm mostly encouraged by the fact that this is a good thing for the college students. And if these brands can use it in whatever way possible for their, you know, to sell their brand, that's great. Like that's a cool win-win. But, you know, to Jack in the Box, I think at least it's great that they found a nice hook, because it means it's not necessarily about finding successful athletes, although they are, I'm sure, but it's mostly about finding that kind of fun theme to run with.
And it's men and women, because you can have it anywhere in your name. So it could be Jacqueline or Jack, or it could be the last name Jackson. So they really were able to cover a wide spectrum, which is nice in terms of gender diversity, racial diversity. They were able to kind of cover the spectrum, which is a nice thing to see too.
Definitely. I agree with Sam. It's great to see restaurants also taking advantage of this rule and, you know, expanding their marketing platform and strategies. And it'll be interesting to see how things like this look in a few years once the rule has been in effect for a while. I feel like right now people are just like, cool, what can we do? Grab an athlete, put them in an ad, like figuring it out, which is great. But I'm excited to see how this all kind of settles in the next few years.
And that noise in the background is birds, because Sam is outside, just in case anybody's hearing that.
Oh, yeah. I have the nice airy ambiance of the outdoors with me today. Do you guys hear the birds?
I can hear the birds. Yes.
And the sun just came out. This is really nice. You should put the video on YouTube so they can see the very, very, what's the word I'm looking for? Pastoral view behind me. Is that the word I was going for?
Is it? Probably not. No. I don't know. We're out in the country and Leanne and I are in sweats in the city. So we are
all bundled up in our New York apartments.
Slow your roll. I live in a suburb. It just happens to have trees. You're telling me I live in the country. Goodness gracious. These people in New York, they think that they own the city to themselves. Jeez.
We'll believe it when we see it.
Yeah. You guys need more trees in your life. Go get more trees in your life.
There's too many trees in New York. They give me allergies. Wipe them all out. Take them all away. Cement over them. That's my very important view.
That's an unpopular opinion, I bet.
Oh, the anti-tree opinion? Yeah, I think so.
Keyword trees.
Keep them all in Central Park. Cover them everywhere else.
If we were doing this live, this is the point at which we would throw up a poll. Tell us, are you pro-trees or are you anti-trees?
We can put that on Twitter, right, Holly?
We can. Only for inside fans of the pod, they would get it.
Oh, boy.
Well, before we jump the shark, see, I like to use that all the time now because I know it.
Mm-hmm.
Another inside joke for the pod listeners.
And successfully used, by the way. Successfully used.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We do have an interview from Brett Thorne this week. He was away at IFIC, a really fun conference, so he was not able to join us this week, but we have an interview with Matt King from Legal Seafoods and Smith & Walensky this week. So definitely stay tuned for that. It's going to be a fun culinary interview. Do you guys have any last thoughts before we turn it over to Brett?
I mean, should we talk more about Cleveland sports? Because like,
I was going to say, go Cleveland. That's my ending note.
Yeah. Go Browns, beat the Steelers this weekend. I'll leave you with that.
Before I turn you over to Brett, I do have a word from our sponsor, Bel Gioioso Cheese. Bel Gioioso Cheese is a family-owned and operated company specializing in artisan Italian cheesemaking. Using only natural ingredients and fresh, local Wisconsin milk, master cheesemakers handcraft a full line of exceptional cheeses guided by a commitment to quality and a respect for tradition. Ask your distributor about Bel Gioioso's award-winning fresh mozzarella, burrata, ricotta, mascarpone, American grana, and parmesan. At Bel Gioioso, every cheese is a specialty. And now, here is Brett.
How you doing, man?
I've been good. How about you?
I've also been good. How long have you been at Legal Seafoods?
Well, we purchased Legal Seafoods December 22nd.
Okay. So you're still with Smith & Walensky, but the parent company. Right.
Correct.
Okay.
So the parent company sort of came about when we purchased Strega Italiano in Boston. And then subsequently the legal acquisition in December.
Right. So you're the boss of Smith & Walensky, or the culinary boss of Smith & Walensky and Strega and Legal Seafoods?
Yes.
Well, that's busy.
It keeps me off the street, not a trouble.
Well, you've had to adjust to a lot of things during, I'm so tired of talking about the pandemic, but it is.
Right. It's everybody's least favorite and most favorite subject at the same time.
Right. Well, we have to talk about it, but it's exhausting. Yeah. So, can we talk about all three brands?
We can talk about all three brands. We can talk about anything you want to talk about.
That is so great. Well, let's start with Smith & Walensky, since you've been there how long?
12 years.
So you've seen a lot of weird stuff when it comes to beef prices.
Never as weird as it's been recently.
So yes, so that's why I wanted to talk about that. Let's talk about supply chain. Well, let's talk about both beef and seafood, because now you have to deal with both. And what's that
yeah.
like?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, we'll start, I guess, talking about beef.
Okay.
Beef has been on this crazy roller coaster, you know, I guess, you know, I'm sure you've heard this from 100 different people, at least at this point, but, you know, pandemic hit, and then you've got all these beef suppliers and all these restaurants closed.
Right.
So now you've got production sitting in a processing plant that isn't going anywhere.
Right.
And they're trying to scramble and involved more in the retail side of things, which, you know, some of the bigger players are, but the more artisan higher end producers, we're really targeting the restaurant and hospitality industry, not the commodity beef industry.
Okay, so prices plummeted because they had all this beef and no place to go because all the restaurants were closed.
Right. So prices drop, right? And then, you know, we're kind of working through the whole everybody's closed situation. So then, you know, beef packers find retailers that want to take beef. They get into sort of the online delivery service. They focus a lot of energy there because who knows when restaurants are going to open again.
Right.
All of this causes a backlog because now you've got feedlots that had cattle in process. And the processing plant can turn around and say, okay, well, I'm going to slow down, right? I'm just not going to process as much. But they're getting backed up at the feedlot.
Right.
Right?
Expensive to feed cattle on a feedlot.
Right, exactly. You know, they're eating 150 pounds a day or so of food, right? That's not cheap.
No. Nope.
And you can hold them for a period of time. But then it gets to a point that A, it's cost prohibitive, and B, you can't really hold them any longer. So that causes a backup. But then even further down the chain, it causes the backup of the cow-calf rancher. Slows down the breeding because the feedlot's not asking for any more cattle. So they've got all these yearling calves hanging out on the ranch longer than they're supposed to hang out, that they've got to feed.
Right. Well, and then if you slow that down, it takes 3 years to make a cow from insemination to slaughter. So,
which is the sad situation that we're in right now.
So
I firmly believe we're going to be, barring any other major outside influence of something happening that shifts demand, if demand stays where it is, we're 2 to 3 years away from this thing righting itself. You know, the herd is smaller than it's been in over a decade. You know, the demand is there because restaurants came roaring back faster than anybody expected them to. You know, so your producers ramp up the slaughter, they ramp up production, they pull everything out of the feedlots are going and dragging everything off the ranches. Now the ranchers are sitting there saying, well, I don't have really much more.
Right.
You know, I wasn't planning for this.
Right. And if nobody, as you said at the beginning, if nobody is buying your cattle, you know, you don't want them, you know.
And not to make more.
Right. And it's time to send them to the feedlot to be fed.
Yep.
Although, does it? I don't know if you go this far up the supply chain, if ranchers have cattle that it's time to send to the feedlot, they can still wander around and graze and eat grass. Is that a huge?
Oh, 100%. They can wander around and graze and eat grass. When they start getting bigger and bigger, obviously, like a human, as we get bigger, our calorie intake goes up.
Right.
So they have to supplement what they're eating.
And that's something. Right.
Depending on where the ranch is located, right? You know, I mean, if you got really, really lush pastures and grazing land and a lot of it, sure, they can survive on that. But, you know, so the interesting thing with us and our beef program with our single sourcing, you know, I just actually came back from the Double R Ranch about a week and a half ago. I try to go every year and spend a little bit of time with them and learn as much as I can learn. You know, it's a 75,000 acre ranch. And there's 3,000 head of cattle on it, which really is not a lot for 75,000 acres. But they can eat a lot. So you need to have all this land so there's time for it to kind of regrow, rejuvenate itself, so you can kind of move the cattle around to different areas.
Right.
So a few thousand head of cattle they can eat a pasture pretty quickly.
Right. So then you have to supplement them with things that you have to pay for.
With corn, with grain, corn, grain, wheat that you're buying from somewhere else, alfalfa that you're buying or growing on another area of the farm, and you're baling and saving. You know, you've got different times of year with the weather. I mean, all of a sudden winter comes and it gets cold and there's snow. a lot of across a lot of our farmland in the U.S.
Right.
There's not a whole lot of natural grazing happening when there's snow.
You have to house the cattle, you have to keep them warm, and you have to feed them hay or silage or whatever else.
Yep. And all this costs money.
Gotcha.
And so I think we're a solid 2 years away. I think that, you know, they've really started to ramp up the breeding program, but as you said, that's a 24 to 36 month process, assuming everything goes well.
Right.
So let's say they started 6 months ago. You know, I still think we're a solid 2 years before it's really stable again.
Well, how has that affected the quality of the beef? Because from what I understand, if you have the cattle on feedlots for longer, then they grow bigger and their marbling gets better and they grade out higher and you get more prime and choice meat, which is what you guys are looking for anyway, right?
Well, yes. So yes and no, right? So they eat and they definitely get bigger. And they definitely get fatter, but they don't necessarily get fatter in the right places.
They don't necessarily marble. They just might have a big fat.
Right. So they get more, instead of intramuscular fat, they get fat in between the muscles. So they have pockets of fat that makes an animal that yields worse.
Right. Because you have all this extra fat that is delicious for frying, but people want to eat steaks.
Right. You've got extra muscular fat instead of intramuscular fat. So it's not that delicious speckled marbled fat throughout the meat that you want necessarily.
Right.
You know, the other thing we've been battling, you know, when you try and throw perfect storm, totally non-COVID related, we've got serious droughts going on. You've got wildfires in the West, right? You've got all sorts of stuff happening. And the grade is actually really poor right now because it's been so hot. There's been drought conditions that the cattle actually aren't grading out really well.
Oh, wow. And, you know, I was just attending the Culinary Institute of America's Menus of Change conference virtually. Yep. And for years, there's been talk of a great interest among a lot of people, including animal welfare groups, environmentalist groups, public health advocates, that we should eat less beef, especially for a number of reasons. And then I get emails all day long from all of the manufactured meat substitute companies.
Yes, like Beyond and all those, yeah, all those companies.
And yet Americans keep eating all the beef. And the rest of the world does too. China's eating more beef, India's eating more beef.
Well, you know, it's funny. One of my bosses over the years used to say to me, you know, no one ever bet a chicken dinner.
Right.
A steak dinner. Right. It's beef and steak is almost like a currency of America.
Right. And as much as we've been talking about the fried chicken wars, a term that I hate, it's not a war. It's sale of chicken sandwiches.
This is not
a war. But we still consume three or four times as many hamburgers as we do fried chicken sandwiches. It's not even a contest.
Yeah, it's not even close. You know, the chicken market would have to grow exponentially to even come close to competing to the beef with the beef market in just sheer poundage.
Well, in terms of burgers and fried chicken sandwiches, according to the USDA, Americans do actually eat a little bit more chicken, but not at your steakhouses.
Not out in restaurants.
Right. Exactly.
More like I eat a ton of chicken at home.
Right.
Right. But like as far as restaurant market share, you know, you end up in a lot of places, you know, unless you're a fried chicken restaurant or something like that, you kind of have the token chicken dish on the menu.
Right.
You sort of have to.
Right. You must.
Right.
But some people are not very imaginative for whatever reason, any steak, you got to give them a chicken.
Yep. Exactly.
So how has that beef challenge affected what you're doing at Smith and Walensky? Or has it? Because your customers still want wonderful beef and that's.
They do. You know, and I think, you know, what we have had going on at Smith & Walensky, it's been a testament to kind of the value of partnerships, you know, and with us, with our single sourcing with Snake River Farms and Double R Ranch and our distributor at Prime Foods, you know, we've been able to get product allocated to us. You know, while I'm not paying the price for it that I would like to, I'm still getting product. And a lot of my counterparts and a lot of friends that I have in the business are getting phone calls from their suppliers saying, I don't have any. You know, and I might get a phone call to say, hey, we're going to be a little bit short on ribs this week, but I have more allocated to you for next week. Right. So it's a little bit of an ebb and flow and a little bit of kind of playing the market of what's available and adjusting your menu as such. You know, that the thing that you know you have readily available, you know, make sure that that appears front and center on the menu to try to avoid, you know, any challenges. And if you've got an item that is running really, really tight on availability, like our swinging tomahawk, our Wagyu swinging tomahawk, right? It's really tight on availability. Well, I've raised the price on that. You know, the price will deter some people, and I have enough product for the people that are willing to pay for it.
When you said you're trying not to pass price on to people, but obviously if you're paying, 50% more for different types of beef, you kind of have to, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, and luckily, again, like I said, the value of partnerships, I'm not paying 50% more.
Oh, good.
Let's say I'm paying 30% more. Maybe I'm passing 15% of that on to my guests and I'm absorbing some of it.
Right.
Because I still feel like, you know, there's a limit to what a guest is going to feel comfortable and happy paying for a 10-ounce filet mignon. There's a limit.
Sure. But so how much are you charging for the tomahawk ribeye?
So the Wagyu tomahawk ribeye is 44 ounces for two people, and it's $225 now.
I mean, it's Wagyu. It's American Wagyu, right? It's
yeah. Farms. Big River Farms. And then, you know, so because that's such tight availability, I'm offering that in three cities. I'm offering it in Miami, in Chicago, and in Vegas. And then in the other cities, I'm offering a prime tomahawk that's $160, same size.
Which is still not cheap, but
no, it's not cheap.
Although for two people, $80 for a steak, that was insane 15 years ago, but now it's normal. But
yeah, you know, when you start looking at the competitive analysis and you see what other people are charging, you know, we're still in our competitive set. We're on the lower to middle end of what people are charging. There's plenty of people out there charging more.
Incredible. And then you have Legal Seafoods, which has a lot more moving parts because there's more than one type of seafood.
Yes. There is more than one type of seafood from more places in the world, and is definitely at the mercy of different challenges.
So, and I was talking to a owner of a smaller little restaurant chain that was going to do lobster tacos as a weekly special, and he said, no, we can't get lobster, so
yep,
no lobster tacos.
And yeah, lobster, we're able to get it, but it's pricey, you know, and a lobster roll is still one of the most popular items that we sell at Legal Seafoods.
And how much do you charge for that?
It's $38.
Mm. For a sandwich.
$38. Now, it's a half a pound of lobster meat. It's, you know, it's an aggressive sandwich. It's a 10-inch long roll and it's a half a pound of lobster meat. But yeah, it's a $38 sandwich.
And as you said, it's still very popular. Customers are like, yeah, I like to spend $38 on a lobster roll.
It's incredibly popular and it's a 55% food cost.
So you ask them, please have some fries, something.
Please order something to go with it.
Yeah. You know, a while ago, a writer for Consumer Publications, which, you know, in my opinion, means he doesn't know anything, was asking, so I want to do a story on, like, the biggest, like, ripoffs in restaurants. Is it, like, you know, truffles and steak and lobster? No, it's pasta and pizza. There's a thing called food cost. And he was like, whoa, food cost? What? And I explained to him, yes, that's restaurants don't make money on steak and seafood.
We don't make money necessarily on the center of the plate.
No. Order a lot of cocktails.
Yep, exactly.
So from a seafood perspective, what has been the biggest challenge? Is it
lobster and crab? Lobster and crab meat are the biggest challenges.
And that's just fluctuating prices and availability?
Fluctuating prices and availability. I mean, you know, a lot of your, like your pasteurized crab for like crab cakes and things like that, it all comes from overseas. Mm-hmm. And that's been really the biggest challenge with that has been the shipping and actually getting it here. You know, which I got an entire lesson from somebody from Nestle Waters about why they can't get me bottled water. And it's not that they don't have the water. It's that they don't have a container to load it in to put it on the ship.
And probably don't have the staff to load it onto the ship, et cetera.
Right. And, you know, now there's a major problem that all the containers are in the wrong ports, empty. And they're not making their way back to the point of origin to get reloaded again, because there's not enough staff working on the docks to reload the empty containers back onto a ship. It's, yeah.
So, I mean, it's weird. This is maybe it's not weird. So it's kind of weird. It's a global issue. In the U.S., some people are like, it's because we are too generous as a government and we're giving them elevated unemployment things. But, you know, as that stuff, as those benefits are wearing out, they're not seeing a lot of people returning to work. And it's not just working in restaurants really hard. Do you have any theories on why there's nobody to work anywhere on earth?
You know, it's amazing, right? Like, because yeah. you find yourself frequently thinking about your own issue, your own industry.
Right.
You think, okay, it's my industry. But, you know, my wife's in retail and it's her industry too.
Right.
Right. So like it blows a lot of your theories out of the water when you start thinking, okay, well, you know, people in the restaurant industry found jobs working in other industries. And I guess there is some of that, you know, restaurants closed, retail closed. So all these guest facing industries shut down. And there is a large group of people that found work elsewhere.
Right.
Whether it's the Amazons of the world and fulfillment centers or Amazon delivery drivers or, you know,
supermarkets,
whatever it is, they found other work, you know, and then they're looking at it and saying, well, I was making this amount of money working at a restaurant, or I'm making this amount of money working here. I'm just going to, you know, I got bit by the fact that restaurants closed. Who knows what's going to happen? I'll stay where I am.
Right.
So I would say there's some of that going on. You know, and you know, it's a challenge. You know, there's a lot of positions we all know in the restaurant industry that didn't historically pay exceptionally well.
Right.
You know, and even though, you know, we always have tried to pay equitably for every position, you judge equity based off of what an industry norm is.
Right.
And I think there's certainly an opportunity to look at some of those, and we certainly have, you know, and making sure that we're paying people appropriately for the job that they're doing.
So are you having big staffing issues?
Absolutely. Staffing issues is definitely huge. You know, those are the two biggest issues presenting: supply chain and staffing. Do we have the ingredients that we need? And then once we do we have anybody to cook it?
Right. And is it more front of the house or back of the house or everybody?
It's a mixture. It's gone with some kind of some ebb and flow to it. You know, I think initially it was more back of house. And then as we're now getting into the kind of kids going back to college, people are leaving, and then there's that transition, which affects the front of house a little more.
Sure.
The back. So now the back of house is staffed better than the front is.
Wow.
So it's, you know, and that'll write itself again when all the college students move into every city. People will start looking for jobs about a month in because they'll realize they need their drinking money.
Right.
And they'll look for a job and they'll get a good job somewhere.
Well, one of the issues I've heard about front of the house is that customers have gotten meaner during the pandemic for whatever reason. I mean, I feel like you guys have classy clientele, but maybe not. Have they gotten meaner too?
Well, I have to say, I don't really see that. You know, I think our guest base, when we reopened, were incredibly patient, incredibly forgiving. You know, they understood, hey, we're just trying here, right? We've got half the staff we used to, they're new staff, we're struggling to get things. We have no idea if we're gonna see 10 people tonight or 200 people tonight, right? We're figuring it out. People were really patient. Really understanding of that. I think, you know, people have gotten to a point, you know, as you've had to raise some prices, that they're maybe a little bit less patient, and they're right to, right? You know, if I'm going to charge you what I'm charging you for a steak, well, then it needs to be perfect when it comes to you.
Right.
It needs to be done right. The service needs to be great. You know, that's, so I don't blame the guest in that respect. You know, that's basically like you come in and you're sitting down and you agree to order a $70 steak. Well, that's like a contract that we have that I'm obligated to provide you service and to provide you a great steak. And that's a bare minimum.
Right.
And that's not like I'm going above and beyond. That's bare minimum. Service is great. Steak is great. The right china, the right silverware, basic bare minimum cost of entry for that. So I don't blame a guest for being demanding and expect that to be right. They shouldn't have to cut us slack forever.
No, especially since you do have to raise the prices and, you know, you're going to have to meet their expectations when you do that.
Yep.
I want to go back to lobster because we talked about crab, which comes, it's a global market, comes from all over the place, but lobster comes from the North Atlantic. So what's the problem? And it's a reasonably sustainable fishery, like they have it under control. So is it just that everybody wants to eat lobster?
It's again a supply and demand situation, you know, and you usually end up going into the winter with a whole bunch of lobster held for the winter.
Right.
But if you think about it, right, we went into the winter in a pandemic. So how much lobster do I hold? People went out fishing less, so they didn't hold as much because nobody wants to be stuck with lobster they're holding.
No.
It's like being stuck with cattle in a feedlot.
Right.
You know? You don't want to run the risk of them dying and, you know, you have mortality issues and potential, you know, sea lice issues and things that can happen when you're holding them together. So, you know, you want to have just the right amount. Just the right amount was not enough as things reopened, you know. So now it's a matter of trying to fish quicker and try and catch more and try and get, you know, caught back up. You know, I've heard people speculating about, you know, the water's getting warmer and that affecting the fishery a bit and the slow migratory pattern of the blue whales and that's impact on the fishing. And I'm sure all of that has to do with it, but I think it was more supply and demand.
Right. And yes, you don't know how many lobsters you're going to need, and you don't want to overdo it. And then the big lobster catching season is the summer, because as it was explained to me, lobsters are kind of like people. They both go to the beach to mate in the summer.
Yep.
So that's what they do, and then you pick them.
Yep. Then they go deeper and deeper in the winter.
Yes.
You know, and they sort of almost go dormant for the winter, and you don't really catch anything.
Right.
So, you know, you get to a point that whatever you have in a pen is what you have in a pen.
Right, and that's it. You know?
And the Canadians typically have always kind of controlled that market as it comes into the winter because they're much more organized in their lobster fishery than we are and work almost as a co-op and shack a lot of lobsters and hold on to them until the price reaches a certain point and then they release them.
And in New England, we have thousands of independent.
Right. They're a little bit more hand to mouth. I'm catching it. I'm selling it. I'm catching it. I'm selling it. You know. That's how they're surviving.
And as I understand it, the processing facilities for value-added lobster stuff is in Canada, so are mostly in Canada.
Mostly, we're working with a company that is in Maine for its processing. They've got one processing plant and facility in Maine and one in New Hampshire for lobster meat for our lobster rolls. You know, but that becomes under pressure because if it's more valuable to just sell it as a lobster and not add the labor, then they're just not going to process very much.
Right.
You know, they're processing the meat mainly because we're forcing them to.
And how much did you say a lobster roll was? $38?
$38.
$38. More power to you.
But I mean, I'm right now paying, it's costing me $45 a pound for lobster meat.
Right. As you said, 55% food cost.
You know, it's... Yeah, $45 a pound plus a roll plus fries plus coleslaw. It adds up.
Please, please, oh customer, buy a beer.
Please, something. Anything.
So you've been at Red Lobster. Jesus, you've been at Legal Seafoods since last December.
Yes.
Is this your first? Well, I guess you have to do seafood at Smith and Walensky too, so it's not that big. The biggest shift. What kind of shifting or what kind of things did you have to learn when you came to Legal Seafoods?
I think as you said, one of the biggest things is it's a little bit more complicated supply chain, right? Because, you know, beef, we find a great beef partner and there you go.
Right.
Most of what we sell is all coming off of the same animal.
Right.
You know, now I've got a lot of different animals that come from different parts of the world, you know, and you're subject to, you know, where is tuna being caught right now? Where is swordfish being caught right now? It's definitely more complex.
And so have you done much innovation at Legal Seafood since you got there? Has there been demand for that?
Yeah, we're actually now on our third or fourth menu change kind of since taking over. Because, you know, we came in and it was very much on a COVID menu. It was really scaled back. And we felt like we needed to give the guests something. So within the first 5 weeks, we rolled out a new menu. We changed the supply chain up. We rolled out a new menu. We added a little more variety. You know, within the Legal brand, there were two restaurants that were branded Legal Test Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
There was a freestanding one in Boston and one at the airport.
Right.
And what we've kind of done is we've taken that Legal Test Kitchen freestanding restaurant in Boston had closed prior to COVID and wasn't reopening. But what I liked about it was thinking about that almost as like a section on the menu and saying, you know, here's the section that we get to play a little bit, you know, test the waters. See how far is our guest willing to go, you know, because Legal's always been known for great quality seafood. Typically, it's been a simply grilled or a fried preparation, choice of a couple of sides, very, very classic.
Right.
So what I wanted to do was like, how can I attract a new guest without alienating the guest that loves that? Right. So everything we buy, everything we bring in now is available simply grilled. Or there's a unique, more interesting swordfish preparation or tuna preparation or a salmon preparation if you want to go down that road, right? So you can get an organic salmon steak with some warm Niçoise vegetables, like garlic caper vinaigrette, some cured egg yolk. Not typical of what you would expect to find at Legal Seafoods. Same great fish you would expect to find. But you know what? If you prefer to have that with rice pilaf and broccoli, you can do that.
As you have 500 times.
So it's sort of on the menu both ways. You know, same with the swordfish, you know, Castelvetrano olives, roasted tomatoes, a little bit of basil, you know, some crunchy Yukon gold potatoes with it, right? Like, so you have the inventive or the classic preparation on a lot of things.
Well, and you're not going exactly crazy on the, it sounds like, on the test kitchen menu. You're using European classics and
exactly. Still keeping it, you know, we're not trying to be El Bulli or something like that here, because that doesn't fit the brand.
Right.
You know, and I think, you know, that's one of the cool things for me with the job that I've had, you know, and for years now with Smith & Walensky, you take a really legacy brand, right? It's known for something. It's respected for something. So whatever you do with the menu, you have to honor that tradition. You know, you're kind of like given, you're sort of like given this thing to take care of, you know, and to help it evolve, but not change it, right? Like, it's not broken, but everything's got to evolve, you know? So it's sort of that slow evolution of, you know, how do we take this brand, keep it very much recognizable for what it's always been, but move it a little bit further into the future.
Makes sense. And do you call that section of the menu Legal Test Kitchen?
Yeah, we do. You know, so and then some items may become, you know, we have a section that's Legal Classics. And some items like like our lobster mac and cheese, right? That was never something that was on the menu. You know, we did a tasting of it and, you know, it was a typical lobster mac and cheese. We had it in a bowl. We took the lobster head and we kind of garnished it with it, put it out, and everybody looked at it and said, well, you know, is anybody really going to pay what we need to charge for this? So I took that as a personal challenge, gauntlet laid. I said, all right, I need to come up with a unique, different presentation. I need to make it look, it needs to have a wow factor.
Right.
You know, so we now take the whole lobster and we split it open backwards. We take everything out of the lobster and we stuff the lobster mac and cheese back into the shell and bake it inside the shell.
That's dramatic and fun.
So it's fun. It's dramatic. It's different. It's an incredible picture. People are like, oh, wow, I wasn't expecting it to look like that when they get it.
Hello, Instagram.
Exactly. You know, you got to have something that's Instagrammable. So we did that and it's become one of our best sellers. So that's going to move from being a legal test kitchen item into the legal classics.
And how much do you charge for that?
I believe right now that is $45.
Jesus, that's a lot for mac and cheese.
Yeah, but it's a whole lobster.
Right, right. Yes, it's a whole lobster and it's with mac and cheese. Who doesn't love that?
Yep.
I'm sure it's delicious.
Yep.
And it's $45.
That's become one of our most popular items.
Cool. So we're running out of time, but I want to talk about Strega and how many locations of Strega are there? Not that many.
Three Strega locations.
And that's classic North End Italian seafood, right?
It is definitely classic Italian, you know, trying to be a little bit, you know, we're a little bit more kind of be elevated over kind of the red sauce Italian, you know, so a little more traditional Italian. Really all about kind of cool, fun service, more relaxed atmosphere. You know, that's been all about, developing our homemade pasta program.
Oh,
you know, so really, you know, we make all the pastas ourselves, even the filled pastas. So that's been a lot of fun. You know, it's right now we've got, you know, for the summer, there's a pea agnolotti that we're making, or mascarpone. We've got a lobster ravioli with a tomato brodo. You know, we've got our twist on an Alfredo that's fettuccine, and then we take a duck egg, Parmesan cheese, some of the pasta water, emulsify that and fold it in. So it's a little more like a cacio pepe kind of a thing, but with the duck egg, so you get that richness.
That sounds amazing. Does duck egg scare away anybody?
It hasn't.
That's good. I mean, it shouldn't, but
it shouldn't. It's just an egg.
Right. You know? It's a bigger, richer, better egg.
Yeah, it's everything you like about a chicken egg, only better.
And so that is a hugely labor intensive thing. So how do you manage that?
So we have a large commissary facility.
Oh, okay.
We do a lot of things out of, you know, and before the legal acquisition, we were doing it in one of our Smith Walenskis. And now we have, you know, like for legal, I make all the clam chowder is made there. You know, we make a lot of our sauces there. We make our Pomodoro sauce for Strega there. So we're able to achieve a lot of consistency by doing a lot of these things in one location versus trying to do them, you know, like with legal in 24 different locations. You end up with some variance.
Right. And, you know, it's just much more efficient to do it in a commissary, so do it there.
Yep, exactly. So we've moved the pasta production there. So everything, you know, all of those sort of things are done there and then delivered out to the restaurants daily.
Awesome. Well, we are out of time, Matt, but I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me about what you're doing. And I'm going out now, so maybe I'll make it back to New England and have some legal seafoods.
Well, let me know if you do.
I will definitely do that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brett. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. Take care.
Take care.